The committee proposed an amendment, and we gave officials some instructions to go and effect those amendments. They went and do their work, but unfortunately, when we were just about to come and present them to the committee, their bosses said no. These are too draconian. We can't accept them as ministers. So please don't table those amendments to the committee. So that's what angered the committee members, to say when the executive were busy with the bill, we didn't interfere. And when it's our time in parliament to effect some changes, I think we deserve some respect as well. That's where the matter was. But thanks again, and I remember service providers as well, they were not happy with some of the things in the bill. Now, having said that, just to refresh your mind, colleagues, you remember that what made us not to accept the bill, one, was that there was this clause about roaming. Now, as a committee, we are saying we don't accept roaming because it will be a frustrating exercise to our tourists. Just imagine, day comes 2010. Now, these people must go and queue at the customs service. After queuing for the customs services, I was going to queue again to service providers to come and register for roaming. We said no, can't accept. That was the issue. The second issue was the registration of because the department wanted the registration to have your register, your number, the handset, the serial number, all those other things that you remember. As a committee, we said no. What about those poor Mamkwena or Mamyanda somewhere in the rural area? Where are they going to get all the time to retire all these things? What about those who are opening a small shop selling airtimes and whatever they? So to put them through all this, the NASA exercise said no, it's not one. And you remember that even the police were saying no, this many registrations is not acceptable to them because they will not be able to police all those requirements. The third issue that was before the committee where we said that I think we can be flexible. There was a request that the implementation period, service providers they requested that they be given 24 months. The department wanted 12 months, and the committee came up with a compromise position, said no, because of some of these dynamics. After a thorough investigation and discussion, I consulted my colleagues now. We said we agreed that they were going to stick to 18 months. Now the question was the implementation period. Now, we'll hear from the department as to whether, because what we were proposing is that I don't know when is the financial year starting of some of the parastatals or service providers or other people who are affected. But I will be guided as to how far can we go in terms of the implementation period. That will say service providers by this time, you must be ready to start implementing this thing in that given 18 months. But we can say from now, that's my personal view, we can say from now, up until next year, 1st of April, service providers must start implementing this thing. 1st of April, that will mean if I want to try and make life easy for members to discuss this thing and having a clue as to the time frame where we're heading. Colleagues, that's where we were when this thing was Now, hey, Cleo is laughing. She heard what I said. No. Now, let me tell you, the department is ready. I was just trying to refresh our memory about the RICA bill, the interception bill. They will take us through it. We're doing this because the two departments that were supposed to respond to questions are not here about the child justice system. Now, I see Honorable Leru wants to address me again. Honorable Leru?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just something very short. I do recall also that there was some discussion as to the cost of implementing the new deal, and that the cost obviously will eventually be pushed on to the consumer. And I can't really recall whether we asked for some sort of analysis as far as the cost is concerned, because it could be quite prohibitive for cell phone users, and I have no idea how much it's going to cost to implement it. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it's a PC. I haven't seen any of the service providers here. I was going to ask them to talk to us briefly about that one. I haven't seen them, and we didn't invite them. Is the one here? Oh, hey. So, Ina, you brought your detachment along, eh? So, Ina, okay. Yeah, if that's the deal, we'll ask them to just talk about it. But I think that's the formal part, and allow Farrell or Lawrence to talk to us. Same members that we had yesterday. I can see same officials that they were there yesterday. There's no need to waste time doing the introduction. Can I formally recognize Lawrence Pasese to talk to us, or going to delegate your power to somebody else who cannot better delegate? Over to you, Lawrence.
Thank you very much, Chair. Yes, it sounded up pretty neatly. Thank you very much for that introduction. Chair, yes, there were discussions that took place, and we got instructions. There were three issues that, as you've already indicated, our instructions were to deal with two major issues which we have dealt with, and I'm going to ask Charles to go through those. The requirement to register roamers, the bill has been amended to do away with that particular requirement, which was a source of some concern. And then also the registration of handsets. So that's what basically what we're coming back to for deals with those bills. The bill, I would like to think, is in line with what the amended bill is in line with the agreement that was reached. And one issue that hasn't been dealt with, but it can be dealt with quite easily by way of amendment, is the registration period. And we would take instructions from the committee as far as that's concerned. It still is at 12 months. I think the last time that we were here, Sarah also introduced some, tabled some amendments, further amendments, not the ones relating to roamers and handsets, but further amendments, and we discussed them briefly, and I would, with your permission, I'd ask them just to refresh the committee's memory on those particular amendments that were discussed, and it would seem, I think, the indication that we got when we were last here that we could table them formally, and we've got those prepared as well. So I'm going to ask Sarah just to take us through those amendments that were mentioned on a previous occasion, as well as the amendments giving effect to the agreement that was reached.
Thank you,
Mr.
Lawrence.
Maybe before Lawrence comes in, Package, do you have a copy of this new amendment? Do you have a copy? Okay. Yeah, continue, Sarah.
So, copies of the amendments was handed out to all the members. The amendments are indicated in double underlining in the bill that was handed out. I'm firstly going to deal with the issues that were raised by the committee regarding the registration of the roamers, the concerns that were raised, and also concerns that were raised regarding requirement that there must be a manual registration of the IMEI number, that is the cellular phone number and the IMSI number, the so-called SIM card number, before I'm going to refer to the other amendments that were previously discussed in the committee. Okay, the first amendment that were affected relates to Section 40 of the Act, and that deals with the information that must be recorded and stored in respect of new customers of mobile cellular operators. Clause 2 of the bill, which means Section 41 of the Act, prohibits mobile cellular operators from providing any service, whether it is the activation of a SIM card or allowing the use of a cellular phone on the electronic communication system, to any person under subsection 2, which lists some information that must be recorded and stored, has been complied with. Although clause 2 does not refer expressly to roamers, the wording implies that mobile cellular operators may not provide a service to roamers unless information listed in subsection 2 has been recorded and stored. In the submissions made to the Select Committee, it was indicated that roamers should not be required to register if certain information can be made available. Submissions to the Select Committee indicated that law enforcement agencies can, with the cooperation of foreign law enforcement agencies, trace roamers. To accommodate these views, the following amendments are proposed. Firstly, in Clause 1, last paragraph, paragraph G, in Clause 1, a new definition of roamer has been inserted. Since specific provision is later on made in the bill regarding roamers, that is a new section that's inserted, Section 40A. Clause 2, that is Section 41, has been amended to make it clear that the prohibition on mobile cellular operators to provide services to customers, particularly that have not been recorded in store, does not apply in respect of roamers. We'll see in Section 41 of the Act a reference to Section 40A, specifically exclude roamers from the operation of Section 40. The Section 40A that was inserted prohibits mobile cellular operators from allowing persons to roam on the electronic communication services unless the system records and stores the following details of such persons or roamers. That is every MSISDN number, the so-called cellular phone number, used with every IMEI number, that is the handset number or the cellular phone number, every IMEI number used with every MSISDN number, and the name of the home network of the person who runs. Furthermore, the information recorded and stored must, on production of a direction, be provided to an applicant within 12 hours. The new provision also contains requirements similar to the requirements contained in Section 14 relating to the security of information in the period for which it must be kept. Furthermore, since the registration of roamers is no longer required, it is proposed that Section 49, contained in Clause 2, should be deleted. This subsection provided that a minister may, in exceptional circumstances, exempt mobile cellular operators from complying with Section 41 and Subsection 2. This sub-clause requires the Justice Minister, when deciding whether or not to exempt a mobile cellular operator, to consider security and crime consideration against various factors, such as the international obligations of the Republic and the extent to which an international event may be affected, for example, the 2010 FIFA World Cup. That specific subsection has been deleted and substituted with another one. I will deal in detail later on with these amendments and refer the members to the bill where they have been affected. Furthermore, the bill clause 2, the proposed section 42, lists the following information which must be recorded and stored by a mobile cellular operator: the MSISDN number, the IMEI number, the INSIN number, and the full name, address, and identity number or passport number in the case of a natural person, and the name, address, and where applicable, the registration number of the arrested person. During the hearings in the Select Committee, it was suggested that a mobile cellular operator should be allowed to report and store the INSI number and the INSIN number through automatic process on the electronic communication system when a SIM card is used with the cellular phone to make a call. The manual registration of this information before allowing a customer to use its system is not necessary. To give effect to this proposal, proposed section 42 has been amended by, firstly, deleting the requirement that the IMEI number and the INSIN number must be recorded and stored, and two, deleting the references to a cellular phone wherever it appears in this subsection, as the IMEI number will not be registered. The above proposed amendments will enable mobile cellular operators to record and store the required information electronically once a call has been made. In other words, a manual registration of this information is not required. The above, or the aforementioned amendments, necessitate consequential amendments to other subsections of the proposed section 40, inter alia, to deletion, to references of cellular phones. As a clause, amending section 62.6 of the Act mirrors clause 2, that is section 40, of the Act, it is proposed that the references to cellular phones in section 62.6 be deleted as well, since the electronic registration of cellular phones will also no longer be necessary. Other consequential amendments are also proposed, for instance, to criminalise non-compliance by mobile cellular operators with the newly imposed obligations. We consulted on the Act. The Minister of Communications requested the parties to effect certain other amendments to the Act. The first amendment that is requested to be effected is that the expression after consultation with the Cabinet member responsible for communication, wherever it appears in section 44B, section 62A, as well as section 48.2b, should be amended to read in consultation with the Cabinet member responsible for communication. The reason, therefore, is that these provisions may have an effect on information, communication.
We are lost. We don't see where it is really. We are lost.
Ma'am, I just tell the committee in the beginning that I'm always giving an overview of what amendments we affected, and that I'm later going to go through the bill with, or refer to the amended sections in the bill to specifically indicate what amendments have been affected in the bill. This is more than just to give an overview of it. Okay,
The one that we're talking to now is the I saw what the determination of status.
These
the one
sections
we're talking to now.
Yeah, with the Minister of Communications, you will see that in section, inter alia, section 42AB, section 44B.
In the document of policy, it's on page 16.
Yeah, in section 62.6, refer that security standards must inter alia be determined by the Minister of Justice, bill currently referred to, after consultation with the Minister of Communications. The Minister of Communications requests the Department or to introduce amendment thereto that will read, in consultation with the Minister of Communications. After consultation means that you can ask the opinion of the other minister, but you don't have to adhere to that. In consultation will more or less mean that there must be some kind of consensus between the two ministers in the consultation process.
Maybe you should have explained that the new insertion in this bill double underline. Yes, sir. Okay. Continue.
Thank you. The ratio, therefore, I think I explained this, that the bill affects issues that relate to communications in South Africa, and therefore the Minister of Communications feel that she must reach some kind of agreement with the Minister of Justice before a decision is made regarding certain aspects. Yes, that is more or less the overview of the amendments that were affected in the bill and which the committee requested the department to affect. One amendment was not affected, as the committee explained, and it relates to the time period for registering prepaid cellular phone users. Currently it's 12 months. I see the committee said that it must be amended to read 18 months. That will be affected. As has been indicated beforehand, the department also affected or proposed certain amendments to the committee before this was the new amendments was affected. I will now go through the bill and indicate where all the amendments in the bill are affected, as well as indicate whether it was an amendment that was already introduced before the new amendments or whether it is a new amendment. The first amendment, if the honourable members can go to page 2 of the bill, it relates to the clause activate at the bottom of page 2. In the first sentence, the phrase network is substituted with the word or the phrase electronic communication system. This amendment was introduced in the committee previously, and it is the result of the new terminology that has changed due to the coming into operation of the Electronic Communications Act. The other amendment is on page 3 of the bill. It's at the lower part. It relates to the definition of customer. Paragraph A is amended in the second line by including the following sentence: after electronic communication service, including an employee of the electronic communication service provider, or any person who received or received such service as a gift, reward, favor, benefit, or donation. The following amendment is on page 5. It is a new amendment, more or less a consequential amendment. It's at the bottom of the page, after paragraph C, in relating to the definition of identity number, the end of that definition, the word and is deleted. This is as a result of the new paragraph that is inserted in clause 1, namely paragraph G. On the next page, page 6, top of the page, the definition in form of settlement, after that definition, the word and has been inserted. Then the new definition has been inserted, indicated as paragraph G, the definition of Rome. The definition of Rome means the following. namely the use of an electronic communication system of an electronic communication service provider who provides a mobile cellular electronic communication in telecommunication service in the Republic by a customer of the electronic communication service provider who provides a mobile cellular electronic communication service outside the Republic to make, receive and send voice calls or data or access other services when the customer travels outside the geographical coverage area of his or her electronic communication service provider. The definition does explain the concept of roaming. It's more or less like if a person of a foreign MCO visits the Republic, he will be regarded as a roamer if he uses his equipment on the system in South Africa.
Sorry, Chief, we're getting totally lost here. Can I just ask the Honourable Gentleman if he's referring to page 6 of this amendment, if he could tell us where it appears in the actual old wording so we can compare. We're having difficulty with that. Thanks, Chief.
This is the committee. I did indicate it was the insertion of a new definition. So there's no old wording in this definition. It's a new definition that was inserted.
Sir, and for example, on the roaming thing, is there a new insertion on roaming?
That's correct. The definition of roaming has been inserted as paragraph G in clause 1. I think I just indicate that. I can just explain again. The old wording in the Act is strike through with a line through it. New insertions is double underlined in the bill before you.
Maybe since as a committee we have rejected the system of roaming, the prefer to have the definition thereof. And if yes, what will be the reason?
I think as we understand it, the committee rejected the registration of roaming as such due to the fact that I think the committee saw it as burdensome that persons from other countries coming to the Republic must queue, have their particulars taken in order for them to allow them to use mobile cellular services. We did consult with all the law enforcement agencies on this specific matter. I think they identified the real need that certain information regarding roamers must be captured. I will explain it later when we go to the newly inserted section 40A, that the particulars that is captured by mobile cellular operators, or which are required to be captured by mobile cellular operators in terms of section 40A, is basically just the same information that they currently, in any event, capture regarding roamers and keep for billing purposes.
What I'm trying to get at, sir, is that in the old bill, we didn't have this definition, isn't it?
That is correct. The definition of roamer was not in the old bill.
Now the question is, who brought this thing here? Because the bill was not passed, because as it was amended by the third committee. Who brought these new things now that's confusing members? Because that's why Honourable is saying, where are we? Because in the bill that they were considered by the committee, we didn't have this thing. So that the hence I said that if it's in, for what purpose, who brought it in? That's going to explain so that members can follow as to where are we now.
I believe the instructions that were given to the department previously in a resolution that was adopted by the committee was more or less to the effect, inter alia, that they've got problems with roaming as it's currently set out in the old bill. and the other aspects that were already identified. We did go back to the law enforcement agencies and discuss it with them. We told them, okay, what we're going to do, we're going to take the concept of ramming out of the old bill. Well, they were actually not happy with that. And they said, don't take it out completely out of the bill. Keep it in the bill. But what you do is just make sure that information that the mobile cellular operators currently store in any event regarding roamers be retained in the new draft that you submit to the committee. That was the South African Police Services. Well, all the other departments actually agreed with that. That is the National Intelligence Agency, the Office for Interception Centres, the Department of Communications, and on that basis, what we did is we re-regulated the position of roamers in the bill by doing away with the old stringent requirement and inserted a more relaxed provision relating to roamers.
Not been able to follow. If I can try in layman's terminology, explain the following. Let me just take you back to the 40 section, 41, as it was before the committee. In that section, never ever did we use the word roam. But in that section was a general prohibition to say that a mobile cellular operator cannot render any service to any person unless certain information has been registered. And the registration in this sense means before you can use this system. But included in that section then, the way it was worded was to say is, if you come from Belgium and you want to enter the Republic, that prohibition will also be will be on you. You will not be able to come here and speak on the phone unless you go to the kiosk, you stand in the queue, and you register, you type down your particulars, your name, your address, the number of this phone, the SIM card number, and your cell phone number, that's 082. So the concern of the committee, as we understand it, was to say no, but that is too onerous for all of the people when they come here and stand in the queue. Do away with that requirement that you must first have your name written into the system of the mobile operator, also having the number of this phone and a lot of things. So what we understood also from the mobile operators all along is they have a system, what they call it, but it's a management fraud system or whatever system. But through that system, if a foreigner comes in today and uses, say, for instance, Vodacom or Cell C, then immediately your number, your NISTM number, what we've got here, but which is that 082 number, is automatically registered on their system, as well as what is the number of this dummy handset. So what we've been trying to do is to say, okay, we will then do away with the requirement of the registration. But what we want to do then is to still be put an obligation on them, seeing that they are capturing some of the information, whether it's in respect of foreigners or what, just to make it a legal obligation on them to have it available when the police or whoever, a law enforcement agency, comes to them. But if you want to put an obligation on them somewhere in the bill to say, okay, you are doing that, but please keep that available so that when we come to you that you will be able to produce that, we must bring it somewhere in the bill. And the moment you do that, you need to then to create a definition for roaming. So that is more or less the reasoning. And as I say, as section 41, as it was worded, the word roam hasn't appeared, or Roma, hasn't appeared in there. But what we're trying to do now is to make it, I cannot say, less onerous
for the foreigners. We need to say, those of you, instead of saying foreigners, if you come here, we say Romans, because you can't use the word foreigner, because it must constitute that thing. If somebody from outside that comes to our country, they have a cell phone and a provider elsewhere, outside the country. Now you come here and you want to use Cell C or Vodafone's system. And then what you need to do is, Vodafone, you need to keep information about, not about that person, but about the call. What I think that
okay,
is...
Ina, okay, Ina, okay, Ina, okay. The question that must be responded to, who gave you the instruction to put this thing here? Sarah said they were given instructions to put this thing here. But I want to know who gave you instructions to put this thing here, because I don't want to shoot the messenger.
I think this no instructions were given, but I believe it was a requirement from the law enforcement agencies that if you proceed with the bill, that minimum standard must at least be captured in the bill. If we do away with roaming, as you know, as explained in section 41, so I think it was only from a practical point of view that we did put it in.
Instruction came from law enforcement agencies. Who are those with so that we check if they can instruct the state committee to put these things in. Now, one other question, I'm a friend when you say it is just to make it less onerous to people who are coming to our country. What was the arrangement before? When they come and they are roaming, it's not automatic that when they make a call, it will reflect to the same provider that this person has called and they can have those particulars. And I want to check why are we having it? What was the arrangement before? Just to check that.
Well, when you're a roamer in a country, what usually happens is that as soon as you switch your phone on and you select the network in which you are and you start to make a call, certain information is captured in the system, on the system of that particular mobile cellular operator. The reason therefore is more or less to bill the overseas cellular operator for calls that you make. So they keep that information. Currently, we don't know how long, the law enforcement agencies actually identified the period that must be kept. So it's actually something that happens every day when you're roaming in South Africa, switching on a cellular phone, that particulars will be captured automatically. So it's actually nothing new.
So it is nothing new. Why overkill? Why put it here if it's happening automatically? Why put it in now if it's happening?
I think just to make it clear, spell out the obligations of the mobile cellular operators and also further to regulate the period for which they must keep this information. Also to put on certain security standards regarding the restoring of that information, which may be used later on for court purposes. I think that is the main reason.
The members are now teaching the one to address the department on this issue. I was not asking for that colleagues, but I just wanted to understand as the background why they put this thing here. If it's improving the bid, it's fine, but if it's tautology, overkilling, I mean, what is the use of that? Because what I was expecting was the department to bring those amendments that were proposed by the committee, not to bring another thing that came from some other people somewhere who. But would accept if it's improving the bill. If it comes from somewhere, it's fine. But if it's complicating things rather than what we know, what we agreed as a committee, because it's not a secret, I can say I consulted my colleagues in the National Assembly. They agreed on the amendment that were proposed by the State Committee before it was aborted. Now, these new insertions, they are not aware of them. And even though I don't need the permission from them, but just for your information. But as I'm saying, if these new incentives are assisting us, assisting to improve the bill, it's fine. But if they put a burden on us users, and our tourists, I don't want to call them foreigners, our tourists who come to our country, and then Hamba Kashi. Colleagues, I can see wants to talk on this matter. Let me allow you, because I wanted to check, we might scream and do this thing, well, maybe service providers, that they don't say anything, they are happy with this amendment, who knows, you know. Maybe as members who might scream and do all these things while they are happy. Maybe I can check themselves before I allow members to talk, because really, there might not be a need for us as a committee to really try to argue if they are happy with these intentions. We must simply say, okay, it's fine, it's not having any negative effect on the bill, it's fine. I have noticed about the forehand from your colleagues, but if you can allow me, let me check with the, I can see one certain Pagamile here, to check if these new infections, are they, just to check your view on those new infections, before I allow colleagues to address us. I saw your hand, the doctor, and Honorable Leroux, Honorable Weston Zindo, Yanda, and Honorable Mac, I saw your hands, but let me allow one of the six providers to address the committee. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I've just looked at the insertion only this morning, so as I see it now. Overall, maybe let me explain one thing that we also explained in the last time we were here, that what presently we get when there's a rogue, it's an INFI number block. And out of that block, you then derive the home network. And then in the process, you get an INEI and the NSISDS. But what has happened since, that was just, I think it was beginning of this year when we were debating this. What has happened since May is that because different networks are at different stages of development, what happens is that presently, with some networks, you can retrieve and you can automatically get an NSISDN number, which is the cell phone number, and the phone number, or INEI. You can. But it depends on the network development, or network, the roaming network development, or stage of development. So it's still a work in progress that's happening with roaming, and the registration of roaming. People who have traveled would have noted that previously, when you're out of the country, if you have an OS2 number, you wouldn't see who's calling you. So sometime back, I think last year, you wouldn't see. Sometimes during this year, when you are roaming, you can actually see who's calling you. If, for instance, a Vodafone subscriber and I call you, when you are in London or in Belgium, then you see that Palamide is calling you. That's what happens now. But that's a development of a particular network. We've got roughly about 600 partners all over the world. Some of those partners are not at the stage of development of their network such that you can automatically retrieve this number. You will still get the number block, which is the IMC. It's actually the SIM card block production, and that says this SIM card is the one that's calling, and then you take it to the network and you bill accordingly. The network, the home network, then identifies that. That's the tricky problem with this provision, is that it simply doesn't take into consideration the levels of development of the different networks. Yeah, it can sort of happen. But whether it will be complete by next year and every network in the world will be able to do this, I don't know. The other element I may just point out, I was asking Sean here and colleague to just quickly check, is that even in South Africa, you see, if you look at the totality of the bill, it's talking about mobile cellular network. Most of the operators that are going to, or whose licenses are going to be converted, actually will be providing all these different services, including, a practical example is Neotel. And Neotel has not exactly engaged on this, but they will be affected by it. All I'm saying is that, and they are using a slightly different technology from DSL. It is CDMA. I'm not sure, I can't talk for them. I'm not sure how it's going to affect them. But insofar as roaming is concerned, that's the situation. It's not highly problematic. It's a development of systems, and those systems will need to be developed in such a way that they can do what is required. And if I can interrupt you, if I will ask you that question, say, can you respond to this question to say, these new insertions about loan, are they assisting in improving this legislation? Is it causing any further burden to us users or to people who will be visiting our country? What's your take on this one as service provider? Are you happy with this inflation? Is there anything wrong with them? Because as a committee, if really the department is assisting us, we'll accept it. But if it's just overkilling, we'll definitely reject this. People said, no, we don't want them. Let's stick to what we had before this thing was aborted. But that's a question I want to put to you directly. Unless this way, your colleague Sean wants to come in as well. But the question is put to you directly, Parliament. What is your view on this new incentive by the party?
Sure. Let me be frank. On the face of it, I think it's problematic. Purely because there's a lot of dimensions that are uncertain on it. That's what I can say. When I read it now on the face of it, I don't see a burden on the consumer. The burden is purely on the operator. And I don't know how, probably there should be an engagement if there is a requirement really to put it in. And let it be put slightly differently. Either, I don't know, authorize the minister to I'm not sure how to respond to it. It is a burden on operators. That's what will happen. We will have to do it, but we will be held back by the different levels of development of the different operators that we roam with. Maybe Sean can quickly add that.
Mr. Chair, certainly the systems that we have are able to cater for the information that is required in terms of the IMEI number and the MSISDN. However, we are 100% reliant on the networks that are roaming to pass us that information. And should they choose not to do so, they're not forced to do so at the moment, and should they choose not to do so, we will not be able to capture that information.
Thank you very much. Honorable Leroux, you're the one who raised your hand first, followed by Honorable Mustegi, Dr. Fanier, then Honorable West, or the Dr. Wade, Honorable Mubizi, and Honorable Nyanda, and Meg on the line as well, and Honorable Van der Merwe, all of you. In that order, yes, Vera.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think at our previous meetings you asked whether the systems that we're going to put in place is more onerous on the user and the visitor to the country than, for instance, if I go to London. Are we using more or less the same system, or is it more difficult to operate your cell phone when you come from outside into South Africa than for us when we get to Europe or whatever? Then number two, I think if it's a burden on the service provider, so you are certainly not going to carry those costs. The service provider will push it on to the consumer. That happens every time, and it's not a disgrace to do that. That is business. So if it's a problem to you, it's actually a problem to us who's going to use your system in the end. And then lastly, I seem to find that the story, we've got the information it seems to us, but the problem is we want to secure the storing of that information, and we want to force the service provider to store it as long as our police services want them to do it. And I don't think that should be any problem. Thank you.
Just tell me that for us. Yeah, let's come, Honourable West.
Thanks, Chair. Yes, as far as this roaming clause, it is more relaxed than the previous wording, and I haven't got a problem with safety and security wanting those requirements, but is it implementable? We've heard already from some of the operators that there could be problems getting this information. That's the one aspect. So we've got to make sure it's not just enacting laws if they can't be implemented. Got to be found that, you know, is this implementable? And if so, if not so at this stage, when will it be able to be implemented? You know, when will they have all the various operators have the sophistication or the services that will make this information available? That's the one aspect. The other one is, just going on a little bit onto the next one, it says under two on the amendments from the date of commencement, and I know we're not at that section, but this will also affect the roaming. An electronic communication service provider must, subject to subsection 4, at its own cost, implement a process to record and store. Now, that is the service providers, their own cost. Now, I mean, some of these, with all due respect, these service providers make a lot of money on these things, so that should of its own accord not be a problem, but often they have got agents or sub-agents who sell SIM cards at stores, shopping centres. Those people aren't going to do that free of charge. So, you know, what is the ultimate cost going to be incurred by these service providers? I think that is also a very important problem, because as we have heard, possibly those costs will be passed on to the subscriber. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, before you address us down to Fundamental, if I want to be silly, I'll say the committee rejected this thing of roaming, but the department brings it to the back door. Mm-hmm. Using a semantic to bring the back door. Honorable Fundamental.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Honorable Darrell Worth covered me with most of the questions. I just want to ask the same questions about when we can implement it and the cost of our time.
Yeah, we'll ask the same provider to tell us when can they be ready to implement these things. That's a good question. That's Honorable Mac.
Well, I didn't want to say anything, Chair, because I agree totally with you. And I'm still at the same position as rejecting it. It's just another way of getting it through.
Yanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think really what we have said now is that we rejected this bill, and it comes back in another way as if we are going to accept it. Really, it's still the very same bill that we rejected in the past. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairman, we have to check with the service provider, because they say that this is going to provide a burden on their part. They will not be able to capture the information. Now, at a particular point when we were discussing this, we were asking the department what is the real overall objective about this. One, in their response, one aspect of their response was it has to do with the security. It has to do with the security of the country. It has to do with dealing with criminals who are entering the country. I understood that to be the overall
in part, Chairperson. We believe that it is a responsibility of all of us as citizens, as business people, all role players, to ensure that when we say we need to deal with crime, we should all agree on that. It would appear that the department is very persistent on that aspect. It would appear that persistency is informed by the view, in a way, that there is a crime and that crime needs to be dealt with. And one way of dealing with that crime is to put in place very stringent measures. Now, it's a burden on your part. In concrete terms, to assist the department, because the department has that responsibility. By the way, the department is a government, has that responsibility of dealing with the crime. In concrete terms, what are you actually proposing in alternative to what they are proposing, or alternative proposing? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I fully agree with you when you say if the version is read now, for us, it's healthy money. It's in no way that the program is going to get. But if it is indeed actually bringing something that they have rejected and then with a new quota painting, then it's not going to help. Now, if I may ask in simple practical terms about this roaming, put it in two categories. There are people who are travelers representing companies and many others. Automatically, those people are roaming. Now, how do the information being captured in the country where they are going? Are they themselves going to inform that country, or the network from my country, it is actually transmitted to wherever they are going? The second category is probably a lay person who now, that is now a person who is visiting a country. If that person, when that person approaches the service provider and says, now I'm going to the suit, I want my cell phone to roam. Is it me who is going to phone the suit network that I'm around and I want to do this, or is my service provider who informs them that I am there? Probably just to get that thing so that it's captured in the digital. How do we go about? Where does it start? Thank you.
Colleagues, I want to make a statement. It might sound harsh, but I don't have a choice. I must make this statement. We'll at all times expect departments to respect committees in parliament. And we're going to expect even the executive to respect our role as oversight practitioners, as parliament. And it's a high time when a committee has decided on an issue, or on any legislation, or a bill like this, please, can we be respected as parliament? Because what I'm seeing now, as a committee, we agreed on some amendments on this bill. As I said, I consulted with my colleagues in the NDA. We agreed on all the provisions that were there before the bill was aborted. But the other thing now, we get the information that some people gave instructions to these officials to bring an amendment that are not known to us as a committee. I'm therefore going to rule that let the department go back, go and clean this thing, bring the amendment as agreed to by this committee. No other edition. If we add anything, it would be based on our discussion between ourselves and ourselves. Whoever is given instruction, go and tell this person that we are saying as a committee, we don't accept anybody to give parliament instructions. As far as this discussion is concerned about this RICA bill, we are going to stop the discussion now. They will come back at 2 with amendments that are known by this committee. No other thing, anything from whoever caught us. that's the decision of this committee. So we're going to break for only 5 minutes, let's stretch our feet, and continue with the child justice bill. As far as RICA is concerned, we are adjourning this thing. Let's break for now for only 5 minutes. We start with the child justice immediately after 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
No, that's fine, Chairperson. I think your proposal is fine, but I think there are questions that we have. They will respond to those questions.
Okay. I think providers will respond as well then to those questions that were directed to them. Thank you very much. Can we have a break in 5 minutes?
Colleagues, you asked questions to the service providers. I wonder if you want them to respond now or they respond then, when we'll be debating this thing. The questions asked there. Now that day, I can see Paramil is there and Mukab, they're still here. But the ones to start with the child justice now. But maybe before we start, let me check with the Paramil. Do you want to respond to the questions that were directed to you by the committee? There was one or two questions there. I want to remove this thing so that when we meet at 2, at least we have heard. Or you prefer to respond when your friends, your good friends are here. Can you address me, Parker? So we can respond now. And if it's inadequate, then we can get additional information and add that at 2 o'clock when we meet back. But fundamentally, what we are saying is that the burdensome issue comes from the fact that we are expecting other operators internationally to actually change their system because we ask it. They are not required to comply to South African law in any way. But because we are required to respond to South African law, we will then have to ask them, can you provide this information? If they provide it, then that's fine. If they can't provide it, then we are sitting with a problem as South African operators. And on the other hand, it may be, say, I'm not talking for Cell C or other operators, I'm talking for Vodafone, and as Vodafone, we may probably be able, because we are one of the biggest operators in South Africa, we may be able to do that, but the other operators at Cell C may be highly burdensome. And all. On the cost, that we will incur on this, and as the honorable members correctly pointed out, the tendency is that some of these costs that are unintended, they end up one way or another being passed on to consumers. That's the first thing I need to say. Not because we like it, but we get an obligation, and then we'll have to find a way of saying how do we recover the cost of doing that. That's one. But on the initial calculations that we had, well, on the original drafting of the bill, the estimation was that it was going to be between 100 and 150 million to implement, million rand to implement the RICA. That's because you, besides putting the systems in place, you have to give incentives for people to come and respond in time and register. Some of the examples that we made last time when we were discussing with the committee is that the tendency in all jurisdictions that have ever carried out the RICA is that you can put a 12-month period or an 18-month period or whatever period you put for registration. If you take, for example, we even made last time the example of the Financial Intelligence Services Act, where people were required to re-register their bank cards and all those things. And what happened? You know, it was actually the driver's license issue, where people simply didn't respond and were going in dress and dress to re-register and all. And then come when the deadline was 2 months,
2 months before deadline, everybody started flocking into the driving testing station, and then they had to request an extension just because of that response. So in order to try and take care of that, we then said we may have to put incentives in place. We will anyway require, because we can't use the existing records, the existing resources won't be adequate to register every prepaid subscriber that's there. So we will have to get other people to do the registration, and you would have to provide incentives to those people and to induce people to actually come and register. So the totality of those costs, besides putting the actual systems in place, like the fields that you must register, which now are becoming much more clear, because MSICN, the number itself, and the ID, the address, and well, it's few information that needs to be verified in order to register a person. On that basis, the cost may be lesser than originally envisaged, but there will still be those incentives. What we then also did a calculation on is that if you take Vodacom alone, we have roughly around 15 million prepaid subscribers. They churn at a rate of roughly about 42%. Now, if you've got such a churn rate on prepaid, it means people are changing their prepaid numbers roughly out of the 100%, 42% change their numbers. So it means you continuously have to register those people that's in AI. You continuously need to register people and make sure that people have their prepaid numbers are registered. Now, on 15 million with a time period of 18 months, we would have to register 830,000 subscribers per month. Now, to register 830,000 subscribers per month, you would have to just make sure that you have incentives in place to induce people to go to the registration point. Just remember, these are prepaid subscribers. Fine, when they say you must cut them, but even if you cut a subscriber, that subscriber must still be able to access emergency services. It's another legal requirement. You can't cut off somebody, no matter how that person doesn't pay his or her bills. You can't cut that person off from emergency services. So that's the ballpark figure, the estimation of the cost of doing this. But I'll find more additional information if you require so, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you.
Maybe before I leave you, if you were to say, when do you think they'll start with the process? When can that be? Tentatively.
What happens now is that we are more or less certain on the fields that I have got to be registered. The only implication of this is that whereas initially, possibly at the beginning of the year, we had budgeted for it, then that budget had to be taken away purely because there was no clarity on when the RICA is going to be implemented. We would need to go back to the board and motivate for that additional budget in order to do the registration because it's a legal requirement. Now, for Vodacom, whom I can talk about, I think the MTN financial year end in December, our financial year end is 31st of March. For Vodacom, we would be much more comfortable to start that implementation by the 1st of April, meaning that we can put all the systems in place in the period before that and get the required resources from board and all. But I'm talking off the cuff, Chair, because I would have to go back to the MP and say this is the proposed date for implementation.
No, it's fine. I think it's clear. Thank you very much, Chair. That will make life easy. When you come back at 2, I think you have responded already. Yeah, that takes care of the first question for now. We identified the child justice yesterday. There were stinging questions that were asked yesterday. The Department of Social Security, in the name of SAPS, they were not here.
I expect to see you back at 2, Carson. Now, we are going to. There are now reps from SAP. But Sharon, you must send them an invoice for the service you rendered on their behalf yesterday. Yeah, can I know who is here so that they are telling me that the colleagues, like enough, Sharon has given them those questions that you asked them. So they are going to respond to those questions immediately thereafter. We'll continue the briefing. So it's not that we'll continue where she left off so that we move. We might move with speed today to see if we can get to some conclusion of some sort at some point. Let me know first who is here, and then let's take it from there and respond to questions.
Thank you, Chief. Next to me is Senior Superintendent Marga van Rooyen. She is working with my components, and we are attached to legal services in the South African Police Service. I am Commissioner Tassius Galvanek from the legal services of the South African Police Service. Do you want me to continue with the questions that we received? Thank you, Chair. Chair and honorable members of the Select Committee, we received a number of questions, and please, I will briefly repeat the question, and if I misunderstood the question, then you can assist me to just make sure that I understand exactly what is required of us. The first question related to children in the age group 18 to 19 years. How will the South African Police Service handle summonses and warrants of arrest for such children? Sections 18 and 19. That deals with summonses and arrest. And the question that was asked was, how will the South African Police Service handle summonses and warrants of arrest for children? Now, Chair, if I may start with summonses, the approach that we follow is basically the same as that we will follow with any other person, an adult person, which means that once the summons is provided to the South African Police Service, we will serve it on the person. In the case of a child, obviously the service will then include serving it on the parents of the child, one of the parents, at least one of the parents of the child, to ensure that the parent will take note of the fact that the child must be at court on a specific day. So that is as far as the summons is concerned. Now, the bill makes provision that the police service can serve it on the child alone in those circumstances where it is not reasonably possible to quickly locate the parents of the children. That is possible. And in those circumstances, we will obviously serve it on the child and not on the parents, and then try and locate the parents thereafter to ensure that we provide them before the hearing with a copy of the summons and serve it on them. Obviously, as the bill requires, we will explain to them the import of the summons so that they will understand what their obligations are and what the consequences will be if the child should not come to court. Arrest, let me just go back to a written notice to appear at a preliminary inquiry. In those instances where a preliminary inquiry in terms of the Child Justice Bill will be held and the child is not in detention, then in those circumstances the written notice will be served on the child and on the parents. And inevitably in those circumstances where a child where a written notice has been issued, the child will no longer be in police detention, but the child will be in the care of some caregiver somewhere. And what we will do is we will serve the written notice both on the person who is the caregiver and on the child to ensure that they understand exactly. We will explain to them the nature of the obligation, what is expected of them, when to be there, at what time, location, etc., so that they understand exactly. We will also explain to them what will be the effect thereof if they fail to appear. And that constitutes a criminal offence. And therefore, in those circumstances, the parents of the children may actually be charged with a criminal offence and upon conviction be sentenced in those circumstances where they fail to produce the child at the preliminary inquiry. So that's basically the approach that we will follow with regard to children. Then, Chairperson, I wish that all the questions would have been easy. So some of the questions are almost impossible to answer, but let me at least attempt and do the best we can. One question was, what are we going to do with the transportation and detention of children separately? And will this include the possibility of a child who is a transvestite, transsexual children, gay and lesbian children, and whatever their sexual orientation may be? How are we going to deal with that? Chair, to be completely honest, if we arrest a child or we transport a child, and that child is a boy, that child will be transported only with other boy children. In other words, we will, insofar as this may be reasonably possible, we will separate persons who are females and persons who are males. Now, that's a simple one, the straightforward one. So if we know this is a boy, he goes with the boys. If we know it's a girl, that girl goes with the girls. Now, what are we going to do with the gay men and the lesbian children? Well, as far as the gay is concerned, it's still a boy. So that person will be transported together with other boys. That's the existing situation. This is our existing arrangements within the department. If the girl is a lesbian, she will be transported together with other female girls. Now, the moment we deal with a transsexual child or a transvestite, that's a completely different story. We have, until today, not yet encountered a specific problem as far as transvestite is concerned. So this is something which will be extremely exceptional. It will very seldom happen. And at this stage, the only thing I can tell this committee is that it will be impossible for the police service to make provision for separate transportation provision for persons that are actually transvestites. So the existing rule is what we will instruct our members to do. We have not done so because we have not yet encountered the problem, but what we will do is we will instruct our members that such a child must be transported separately from other children so that we don't run the risk of the one child molesting or interfering with another child. So the instruction will be that they should be transported separately. As far as their detention is concerned, we will issue exactly the same instruction. The problem that we have, and this is something that the committee needs to take note of, is we have limited capacity in our police holding cells. So in those circumstances, where it is an instance where we arrest such a child and the child needs to be detained, we will obviously, as with any other child, put in place every reasonable possible measure to ensure that we can release the child without taking that child into a detention facility. That's not, we do not want children in police cells. In those exceptional circumstances where we cannot do otherwise than detain a child, once again, female children will be detained together with other female children. Male children will be detained with other male children. We have not yet issued instructions with regard to transvestite, gays or lesbians. But once that, but this is something in respect of which we will have no choice but to make provision for separate detention facilities. Unfortunately, we may not have. In those instances where we do not have it, our existing instructions, if there's a child that must be detained, and we don't have place, your children detention facility is, for instance, already overcrowded, or there are too many people, and we don't have place in it anymore, then the child cannot be detained, together with adults or with another gender. So, such a child will not be in a detention facility. What we will do with such a child is to remove the child and take the child to a place of safety, where the child can be kept until the hearing can take place. In other words, in those instances where all possible measures to release the child without detaining the child prove to be ineffective in the long run. So that will be the instructions that we will issue. They have not yet been issued, I must say, but somebody brought to my attention that there was an instance of this nature in the vicinity of Beaufort Bay. We will take this matter up and we will issue such instructions. We have never encountered this problem in the past, so therefore we have no specific instructions, but we will issue them immediately. Then the next question dealt with the question, how will the police deal with children when the age of the child is under? Now, there are three possibilities. The one is that the person is above the age of 18, but we are uncertain whether he may not be younger than 18. In such a circumstance, we will deal with the person as if that person is below the age of 18. In other words, we will always resort to the youngest possible age of the person until we have finality about the age of the person. The problem we have with that is that I have personally witnessed instances where a person who is 24 years old, indicated he's 60. And if you look at that person, it sounds quite possible that he may be 60. The difficulty that we have is that if we place that person who is 24 years old in a detention facility together with children that are below the age of 18, then we have a situation which we would like to avoid at all costs. So, what we have issued already to our police members is in those circumstances where you are uncertain, you have to take immediate action to determine at least with a relative degree of certainty what the age of the child or the age group of the child is. So that will require that the police, in terms of our existing instructions, before this legislation comes into being, they will have to take the child to a medical practitioner who will determine and perhaps may not be able to give the exact age of the person, but will at least be able to say unlikely to be under the age of 18 or quite possibly under the age of 18. If the person is a child below the age of 18, according to whatever was determined by the medical practitioner, we will deal with them as if he's a child. And that's the way we will handle it. If we move lower and we move in the direction of 10 years of age, in other words, the question is, can we arrest the person? Because it is possible that the person may be less than 10 years old and may therefore not be charged for any offence in terms of the proposed dispensation in this new legislation. Then, once again, we will deal with the matter as if the person is a child below the age of 10. And to tell you the truth, Chairperson, I believe that the majority of children should, in any event, not be detained in police. So, when there's uncertainty as to whether a certain child is below the age of 10, we will prefer not to have him in the police cells at all. So every possible step will be taken to have the child taken, perhaps removed from his or her parents or place of residence, but taken to a place where he can receive alternative care and protection. So we will follow the process as if the child is below the age of 10. And then eventually, through the preliminary inquiry and other methods, we will determine the age of the child and act in accordance with that. If the child is then turned out to be below the age of 10, it means the matter must go to the children's court. There's no criminal case. If the child turns out to be above the age of 10, then the matter will go to the public prosecutor. The Department of Social Development will be duly notified, and the matter will then proceed in terms of the provisions provided for in the bill. The next question, once again, very difficult one. How will the South African Police Service deal with cases where children steal because they are hungry? Now, Chairperson, this is in our society in which we are living in today, it is a reality that there are certain circumstances. We have street children, we have young children that are in circumstances where they don't get proper nutrition and proper food. So it's quite possible for a child to steal in order to obtain food. The basic point of departure is we deal with that criminal offence as we will deal with any other criminal offence. In other words, below the age of 10, social development, child will be removed and placed in a place of safety and protection. Above the age of 11, the police will investigate the matter, there will be a preliminary inquiry, we will try and get the child as soon as possible out of our police holding cells, if that turns out to be the case that we arrested him, and then the approach will be followed under normal circumstances. In those circumstances where the probation officer, and this is very important, where the probation officer, after having interviewed the child and the people involved in the incident, he satisfied that the child actually stole whatever it is that he stole because of hunger, because he wanted food, and it may not necessarily be food, because it may also be that he steals something to sell in order to get food, which is basically the same thing. Then in those circumstances, this is a matter where I believe the social development system in the country should make provision to deal with the child, because the child is actually in need of care and protection. Although there will be a criminal matter, I believe that the Department of Justice, the public prosecutor, will take that into account, and because the public prosecutor has the discretion to institute a criminal prosecution or not to institute a criminal prosecution, it is likely that the public prosecutor will not institute a criminal prosecution if from the investigation, from the probation officer report, it appears that the child was actually hungry and therefore stole whatever it is that he stole in order to get food. This is also a matter where the National Prosecuting Authority may come into play, and I believe that the National Prosecuting Authority is likely to issue directive in terms of the National Prosecuting Authority Act to its public prosecutors on how to handle cases of that nature. But this is not inside the police. As far as the criminal case is concerned, it will have to go on. And we believe the public prosecutor will deal with the matter in accordance with his or her directive. As far as a child with even a criminal offense, but the child is below the age of 10, then obviously we will pass the matter on to the Department of Social Development and will no longer be. The next question was, does the South African Police Service inform the Department of Social Development when children are arrested? And the very simple and straightforward answer to that is yes, because the child must be seen by a probation officer within a period of 24 hours after his or her arrest. So what our existing instructions are, that the local representatives of the department and local available probation officers must be notified immediately. And for that purpose, we have an agreement with the Department of Social Development in terms of which they provide us provincially with the information, the contact particulars of probation officers that will be available to handle the initial interview by a probation officer of a child that is arrested. So, the process will be as follows. Number one, do we arrest? Preferably, we don't. If we find it necessary to arrest, probation officer will immediately be notified. We have control measures in place to cover that. There must be an entry in our station diary that the probation officer has been contacted, what the response of the probation officer was, and if necessary, the child must be taken to the probation officer. If it is possible, what we prefer, and the probation officer can come to the police station and we can make facilities available for the interview, then the probation officer can come. And depending on the outcome of the probation officer's interview, we will take further action after that. Obviously, the children the parents of the children will also be informed, and in those instances where the parents cannot be found, we will request that the, or we will instruct, and this is our existing instructions, an appropriate adult person must be informed after detention of the child. The Act itself describes exactly what is an appropriate adult in terms of our existing instructions, which will obviously change when this new legislation comes into being. The concept of an appropriate adult is much wider, but we believe that the concept of an appropriate adult as defined in the Act will make it possible for us to identify somebody that can actually take up the position of an appropriate adult. Then the next question dealt with our detention register, and the question was, as required in terms of the new bill, the particulars of children in detention of the South African Police Service must be separately recorded. What we understand under separately recorded is it must be recorded in a way which is clearly distinguishable from the detention of an adult person. Now, this is open for interpretation. Our existing approach is, but this will, we are in the process of changing that, our existing approach is that we have a register, a handwritten register, in which the detention of every single person that is detained by the South African Police Service, that particulars of that person, are entered into that register. One of the qualities which is compulsory for completion is the age of the person. The moment when the person is below the age of 18 years, that entry into the register of his particulars must be read, so that it stands out clear. We are in the process, and this is why I say this is something that is about to change, we are in the process of developing a computerized register, which means we will have a central database in the South African Police Service, countrywide, and the police station with access to computer network, which is in the region of about 96% of all police stations. They will log onto the computer and will then choose the different options. I want to detain someone. Then it will open up a certain screen where you can enter the particulars, which means it will be collectively saved in a database. But every time when somebody inspects the station, or when people go off duty and new people must come on duty, you will have a button that you can press which will print out the detail of all persons in detention, adult persons and youth members of children. And that person, when he goes off duty, together with the person who's coming on duty, must, both of them must go together and check the detention facilities to determine that the people that are inside the holding cells are on the list. So they can see, number one, has somebody escaped in the meantime? Number two, is there somebody in detention that should not be in detention, which is not in the register? It's a control measure. And if that person's particulars are not in the register, they will immediately rectify it by putting it in the register. Or else, if it appears that one of the persons got injured or something went wrong prior to the new shift coming on duty, then they will be able to deal with that problem immediately. And in this way, they can control and make sure that those that are supposed to be in the police holding cells are there. So it will be two computer lists printed out. But the information will be stored in one and the same database. That's the approach that we intended to take. We further hope to have, with our integrated justice system, have a situation where our computer systems will be linked with those of the Department of Justice, so that when a child is taken to court, at court, they will immediately get the printout and will see exactly who this person is, why he is there, and that he is a child, so that he can be appropriately detained at the magistrate's court in those instances where we have holding cells at the magistrate's court. So the members of the South African Police Service who are in charge of that holding cell will then immediately see that this person is a child and this is the way it must be handled. The question is who monitors. Now, with our existing, and this is important, our existing system is a hand-recorded system. The way in which we exercise control over the correct completion of our register is that the person in charge of the community service center or the detention facility, because at major police stations you have your community service center on one side and your detention portion on the other side. The person in charge of either the community service center or the detention facility, it is his responsibility to oversee that the information is correctly entered into the register. Once we have a computerized system, it will be his responsibility to ensure that the information is correctly entered into the computer. The way in which he will ensure it is immediately after the person has been registered on the system, a printout will be made, and he will sign that the information which now came out of the computer is actually correct. So the person in charge will sign. Then we have a second level of control. This is the immediate control, immediately upon entering the detention. The second layer of control is the person in charge of the shift must, before the shift ends, inspect all the registers, including these registers, and also go and inspect the police detention facility to see that the matters are the same. In other words, that what we, according to our records, should have in the holding cell, that person, these people are actually in the holding cell. Then when the new shift takes over, the new shift commander is responsible to check it once again against the people that are actually in detention. That's our second layer of control. The third layer of control is the station commissioner in the case of a very large police station. The station commissioner cannot do everything himself. He must designate a senior officer at the police station to take responsibility for daily checking each and every register to make sure. Now, in the case of a smaller police station, the station commissioner must himself or herself personally inspect those registers on a daily basis in the community service center or at the detention facility. So that is our next layer of control. Then the fourth layer of control is we have a provincial level inspectorate who will go out and do random inspections at stations, sometimes scheduled, but sometimes randomly, arriving unannounced at the police station. And when they conduct an inspection, they have a certain set of matters that must be checked, and one of those matters relates to the detention of the person. Then the final layer is, of course, that we have the ICD, who from time to time visit our police stations, and we are now in the process, as required by international agreements, to look at the possibility of requiring the inspecting judge of correctional services to come and inspect these holding facilities. So these are the different layers of control to ensure that our information regarding persons that we detain is correct. They will not only check the fact that the person's name is so-and-so and that the person is physically there, they will also check the age of the person against the person himself or herself and take that into account to ensure that they are being dealt with in accordance with their age. The last question that we received is, how does a child get to court when he's released on his own reconnaissance and he absconds? Now, if a child has been released on his own reconnaissance, in actual fact, it is not possible for the police to release a child on his own reconnaissance. There are various possibilities how a child can be released. Number one, the first possibility is that after having detained the child, we establish that the child is not guilty of an offense, or the child is, in the case in the new system, below the age of 10. That means the child must immediately be released and will never go back. So then the child is simply released and will not go back to court. But if a child is a child that can be prosecuted and there is a case registered, a criminal case, in respect of which the child is in detention, then that child can only be released in accordance with the provisions of the existing Criminal Procedure Act and when this legislation comes into being in terms of that legislation. What are the possibilities? One, the child may be released with a written notice. In the case of a child, the written notice, as explained earlier, cannot only be issued to the child, but must also be issued to the caretaker of the child. Because the caretaker must undertake to ensure that the child will be at the court. Okay. So, the next possibility is the child may be released on a what we call a J-54. It means it is a written notice where he may pay admission of guilt. So then the person is released on that written notice and he has the option of paying admission of guilt before the first appearance in court. In such a case, will be issued to the parent of the child and to the child itself, and if they pay the admission of guilt, then we are not interested what that happens to them thereafter. Then the next possibility is the child may be released into the care of his parents, and then we complete a specific form, a form that we call a SAPS 496, which is the release of a person in the custody of his parents, not only parents, but any proper caregiver recognized in terms of the legislation. And then that person has the responsibility to oversee the fact that the child comes to court on the due date. The next possibility is, in certain circumstances, it may be necessary for us to release the child on bail. Then an amount of money is deposited with the police. We will issue a written notice to the person as a receipt of the bail money. And in terms of that receipt, the person will be instructed to appear in court on a certain date and will realize that he will lose his bail money that was deposited. Okay. So that's the next possibility. The last possibility is that the child may be released by a senior public prosecutor with regard to certain serious offenses where the police does not have the power, the competence to actually issue bail notice or a bail receipt and release the child on bail. Once again, it is a bail document and the child will be released in the court's way. Now, let us say, irrespective of which one of the options we follow, it means that there is a legal binding obligation on the child and his caregiver to ensure that the child will be in court on a certain day, at a certain place, at a certain time. Let us say the child does not appear. He absconds. As the question indicates, what's going to happen then? Then, in those circumstances, what will happen is the matter will appear before the matter will be raised in court. The court will ask, where is the accused in this case? The public prosecutor will inform the court that the accused did not arrive, will inform the court and provide the court with proof that the child, accused person, in this case the child, was actually properly released on a written notice, bail form, or into the custody of the parents, etc., etc. Now, irrespective of which one of those options were, or that he received the summons. Now, irrespective of those options, it is within the power of the magistrate to decide, and what they normally do is they will postpone the case for 14 days, and say that unless the child appears after 14 days, because the child may be sick, or there may be something beyond his
No, I think it's fine. Eh? Okay. I think we can get it. Yeah. Colleagues, let me suppress you for now, please. Because I want to give the candidate to continue with the briefing. I can say hands of Honorable Van der Merwe, you. Can I hear you?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I just want to ask one question. They said that they will summon the child or whatever, say above the age of 10. You get it home, parents are not there, you give your summons to the child, the child throws the summons away and is not appearing in court. Who's responsible?
Now, before you respond, I just know the question. You respond after that. There was this serious debate yesterday But it affects yourself and no, all department in fact, and social development. Before I joined, there was a serious debate about probation monitors who can invade the privacy of Mr. Mzizi while he's enjoying quality time with his family. If there's a child who is supposed to be monitored, the movement of that particular child. So there's a serious debate about the invasion of privacy of that particular parent or appropriate adult or guardian. There's a serious debate as to, because the department through first code yesterday, they said they can come to a house unnoticed, unannounced, just come to monitor it because of the order that was given to say. But the order again, family what? Yeah, family time. The child is supposed to have family time with the parents. Now when they do that, the probation officer will just come to the house unannounced just to see exactly if as parents or the child is spending time with the family. Now we'll come to that because really that's a question. There is a debate to say what if when the probation officer comes to the house to monitor if the child is spending quality time with the parents, you find that some other things are happening. I mean, make the same family concern. Now, that's a debate. That's a debate. That clause, we have to come to it because we're having some proposals to make as far as that is concerned. But the probation officer will just come to the house unannounced. As to the question is, who is the monitor here? Who is the monitor here? Because the order is given. It's for the child to see that he or she spends time with the parent. It's not the parents that say, you're going to invade my privacy simply because you want to monitor it. You know? I mean, you know, as adults, as parents, some other things you don't plan for them, they just happen anyhow. Now, that time when that probation officer comes to your house, why other things are happening? Yet now to pack everything to attempt the probation officer to say yes, we're spending time with our child. I mean, all of you are going to respond to this question again, but there's a committee, I think we'll come with something else, with something to propose how can we arrange, we address this kind of a clause. Sister Nazir, are you ready to talk to us? If you want to approach the bench first? No. Are you ready?
I'm ready to
There you go. Continue. We're on here.
Thank you, Chair.
We are on chapter 9. Eh?
Yes, we're dealing with chapter 9, which
relates
to the trial in the Child Justice Court. I'll start by reiterating the point that we made yesterday that the bill does not create a new Child Justice Court. A Child Justice Court, as it is defined in clause 1, is any court which could be a district magistrate court, a regional court, or a high court that is provided in terms of the criminal procedure. But where the child appears in terms of this bill for application of bail or for plea or trial or for sentencing, the Child Justice Court will apply the provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act and the provisions of the bill where it is the criminal procedure is extended or amended by the bill. It is also important to note that where the matter of the child is not diverted, the matter is referred to the Child Justice Court. And the child must appear at the Child Justice Court with the required jurisdiction in terms of the offence that the child is alleged to have committed. And the Child Justice Court may also consider diversion of the matter, and this is provided for in clause 67 of the bill. the provisions of the charter regarding diversion will also apply where the matter is considered for diversion in the child justice court. Another important section that to mention is clause 64, which deals with the referral to the child justice court. This clause is closely related to clause 50. And here in the court where the presiding officer, it appears to the presiding officer that the child that is before the court is a child referred to in clause 50, a child in need of care and protection, then the court must refer the child to be dealt with in terms of the Children's Act. Another important section is clause 55, which deals with parental assistance. The bill provides that where a child is appearing at the child justice court and is assisting for parental or appropriate adult assistance, the court must grant this. A court can dispense with the obligation to have a parent or an appropriate adult present if the parent or appropriate adult cannot be traced after reasonable efforts have been made to trace the parent, or if the delay in tracing or locating the parent would be prejudicial to the best interest of the child or to the administration of justice. Clause 66 is something new, and it deals with the limits regarding the postponement of trial. If a child is in detention in a prison, a child justice court may, before the actual commencement of the trial, not postpone a matter longer than 14 days. If a child is in detention in a child in youth care center, the postponement may not be longer than 30 days. And if a child is not in detention, the postponement may not be longer than 60 days. And that concludes chapter 9. If they will try it, I don't
know. Now, once you continue, and then until we go to part 2 of sentencing.
Chapter 10 deals with the sentencing. And that's from Joseph 59 sets out the objectives of sentencing applicable to children. That is, in addition to any other objectives or considerations which have been developed by our courts over the years. The examples of the objectives as set out in the bill are to encourage the child to understand the implication of and be accountable for the harm caused by the alleged offense, to promote an individualized response which strikes a balance between the circumstances of the child, the nature of the offense, and the interest of the society, and to promote the reintegration of the child into the family and into the community. In order to promote these objectives, the bill encourages the restorative justice approach. Sentences may be used in combination. In terms of subclause 2 of clause 59, it sets out specific consideration to be taken into account by a court when thinking of sentencing a child in a child and youth care center, and further specific consideration when the court is thinking of sentencing a child into imprisonment. Clause 17 makes provision for the handing of the victim impact assessment. A victim impact assessment is a sworn statement by the victim or someone who is acting on his or her behalf, which reflects the psychological, physical, social, and financial, or any other consequences that the offense has had on the victim. And this may be handed over to the court by the prosecutor during the sentencing stage. And clause 71 deals with the pre-sentence report. A pre-sentence report is to be done by the probation officer, to be compiled by the probation officer. This is compulsory unless a child justice court dispenses with with this requirement, and this may only be dispensed with if the offence in question is a Schedule 1 offence, or where further delays in trying to get a report will be prejudicial to the child. However, where there must always be a pre-sentence report if a child is sentenced to a child and youth care center, or if a child is sentenced to imprisonment. If a probation officer recommends in the pre-sentence report that the child should be sentenced to incarceration in a child and youth care center, the recommendation must be supported by a documentation obtained by the probation officer from the person responsible for the center regarding the availability of accommodation in the center. Chapter 10 also contains a number of sentencing options, some of which are innovations in our law. And these sentencing options include community-based sentences, restorative justice sentences, sentences involving correctional supervision, sentences of compulsory residence in a child and youth care center, sentences of imprisonment, or bondment and suspension of sentence. Looking at each of these, dealing with a community-based sentence, this is one of sentences which allow the child to remain in the community, and it includes any of the options, of the diversion options that are listed in Clause 53, which we went through yesterday. And this may be used in combination, as well as sentences involving correctional supervision. In the provision dealing with restorative justice sentence, reference is made to a family group conference and a victim offender mediation or any other restorative justice processes, which is in accordance with the definition of restorative justice, and this is defined in the definition clause. Clause 54 provides for the imposition of fines. Also, it allows for alternatives to fines, like a symbolic restitution or a payment of compensation or an obligation to provide some kind of services by a child to an institution or to a person, which may include a victim. When imposing any of the sentences, the court must request the probation officer to monitor compliance of the sentence by the child. The probation officer then is required to report back to court if the child fails to comply with the sentence. The child is then brought back before the court and an inquiry must be held. If the court finds that the child fails to comply, it may confirm, amend, or substitute the sentence. For a child who is 14 years or older, a sentence may be given involving correctional supervision in terms of the Section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And for a child who is under the age of 14 years, a sentence that may be given involving correctional services is a sentence in terms of Section 276H1H of the Criminal Procedure. Section 276H of the Criminal Procedure is a purely correctional supervision, while 276(1)I is a sentence of imprisonment, but which at a later stage may involve correctional supervision in the discretion of the Commissioner of Correctional Services or a parole board. Now, looking at Section 76, which deals with a sentence of compulsory residence in a child and youth care center, it is an important section, and it deals with sentence of compulsory residence in a child and youth care center. A court sentencing a child for any offense to compulsory residence in a child and youth care center, but must take into account the consideration or the objective set out in Clause 16-69 that we discussed, whether the offence is of such a serious nature that it indicates that the child has a tendency towards harmful activities, whether the harm caused indicates that a residential sentence is appropriate, and whether the child is in need of a particular services provided at a child and youth care center. and also look at the seriousness of the offence and the protection of the community and the desirability of keeping the child out of prison. Generally, this sentence may be for a maximum of 5 years or until the child turns 21, whichever occurs first. However, subclause 3 of clause 76, which is new in our law and is aimed at keeping young children out of prison, if at all possible. This subclause provides that a child who has been convicted of a Schedule 3 offences, the most serious offences, and who would have been given a prison sentence of more than 10 years had he been an adult, may, if substantial and compelling reasons exist, be sentenced to compulsory residence in a child and youth care center. And after that, he or she may be required to serve the rest of his or her sentence in prison for the period that may be determined by the court. When the child completes his or her term in the child and youth care center, the head of the center must submit a report to the sentencing court setting out his or her views on the extent to which the relevant sentencing objectives have been achieved and the possibility of a child's reintegration into the society without having to serve the additional term in prison. The court must consider the report of the head of the child and youth care center and other relevant factors and may, if satisfied that it would be in the best interest of justice, confirm the sentence imposed or substitute the sentence with any other sentence or order that release the child without condition. The time that a child has served in the child and youth care center must be taken into account for parole purposes when the child is referred to serve the rest of the sentence in prison. Now, because of past experience where children who have been sentenced to child and youth care center end up in prison for extended periods before being admitted in the centers mentioned in the court order, this clause also contains a detailed provisions regulating the admission of children sentenced to the center. For example, when committing a child to a child and youth care center, the court must cause the order to be brought to the attention of the relevant functionary and give directions where the child is to be detained before being admitted to the center, and direct a probation officer to monitor the movement of the child and to report back to court once the child has been admitted in the child and youth care center. The court must also keep the matter on the roll for a month or so, and when the matter comes to court, the court must again inquire whether the child has been admitted or not to the child and youth care center. If the child has not been admitted, the court must hold an inquiry and take into account any appropriate action, which may include giving or an alternative sentence. And then looking at clause 77, which deals with a sentence of imprisonment. This clause states upfront two general rules. And firstly, it provides that a child justice court may not impose a prison sentence on a child who is under the age of 14 at the time the child is being sentenced. Secondly, as a general rule, the clause provides that a child justice court, when sentencing a child who is 14 years or older at the time the child is sentenced, may only do so as a measure of last resort and for the shortest appropriate period of time. This wording gives effect to our international obligation and under the Convention on the Rights of the Child and to Section 28 of the Constitution. This particular provision represented departure from our present legal position. At the moment, a child who is 7 years or older but under the age of 14 years can be sentenced to imprisonment. There is an international trend to avoid the imprisonment of particularly young children. Many other countries also prohibit prison sentence for very young children. Moreover, our law at present prohibits the detention of children under 14 years in imprisonment prior to sentencing. The Department of Correctional Services has indicated that it's not equipped to accept children who are under the age of 14 years in their facilities. It should also be noted that this provision refers to the age of 14 years at the time the child has been sentenced, and not at the time of the commission of the offence, which is the general yardstick or the general rule principle in terms of our law. The provision is intended to keep children under the age of 14 years from going to prison. Clause 72 sub 2 confirms the minimum sentencing legislation is applicable to children who are 16 years or older at the time of the commission of the offence. So the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which is known as the sentencing legislation, will apply to a child who is 16 years or older. In terms of Clause 77.3, a child who is 14 years or older at the time the child is being sentenced and who is not subject to the minimum sentencing legislation may be sentenced to imprisonment if the child has committed a Schedule 3 offence or a Schedule 2 offence if there are substantial and compelling reasons. This child may also even be a child who has committed a Schedule 1 offence if the child has a record of relevant previous conviction and there are also substantial and compelling reasons. A prison sentence in terms of this clause can go up to 25 years. Sub-clause 6 of our clause 77 recognizes our international commitment in terms of Article 37 of the Convention of the Child, of the Rights of the Child, by providing that no law or sentence of imprisonment may deny or restrict or limit the possibility of earlier release of a child sentenced to any term of imprisonment. That concludes chapter 10, which deals with sentencing.
Yeah, right. We can pause here. We can pause here and allow a space for questions, I believe. I saw I deliberately allowed Umadam Kosana to take us through these two chapters, so that we make up the time that was taken by Florence and his cabal. Yeah, colleagues, any questions from clause 63 to clause 79? Honorable Mthuli, followed by Honorable van der Merwe, and then Honorable Zizi.
Yeah, the first question, mine will be directed to the staff. I just want to check the computer linkage with the Home Affairs, because seemingly the commissioner, the way he was presenting that, how are they going to monitor. The experience we have encountered when we visit the police station does not concur with what he is saying. I mean, if you look at these things being written in the register and
for a person to check, for a person in charge to check these things. I will agree if we are connected in the computer where a person can just recall. But if you talk about the manual thing, then it looks like wishful thinking. I mean, if you can tell us how long will it take for the system, justice system, to be connected to, let's say, to Home Affairs, because sometimes you, let's say you are going to welfare, you find that they say a person has deceased. But when you go to Home Affairs, they say, no, this person is alive. Some of the people I was looking for these grants, sometimes people will not get a grant because in the welfare offices, they say this person is deceased. But when you go to Home Affairs, then they say, no, this person is alive. And you wonder, why is it not linked? Why do we have the different information? And I want just to check the system, this computer system, because you keep on saying, I mean, the department keeps on saying, no, it will be correct if we are connected, but you don't hear when it is going to be connected. And, I'll just take you back. The base system, you know that the outside, the people outside there, they think the system is not working because they see a person being arrested and then the following day gets a bail and it's outside. And they say, usually they blame the self to say, self are not working, we've arrested this person but tomorrow he's out. And people do not understand this thing of a bail. Now I'm looking at this. At this child justice thing, because most of the crimes are committed by people whom we call children, like 15, 18. Most of them, if you go to Westville or wherever, those people are there. And if you look at this system where you are going to be, they are going to be released. And you were saying there, you did not mention the schedule, whether a person will consider whether the case is schedule one, the offense is schedule one or two. You just said the charge will be given this and this and this. Because our experience is that these kids, they shoot. You find that they kill. And I'm afraid to... people are going to use the mob justice when a person is shoot somebody and he's being found, he's being seen around while we are trying to take care of the child. And the people will say, no, man, the system is not working. Let us kill this person. And this thing, I'm worried about this... the age, because my experience, I remember there was a person who was taken as a child, but we knew that he was above 20, and he killed the people, he's arrested, then they find that he's a child, he got a bail, he's out, and then the community started to worry, to say, no, it means then we must take the law into our hands. I just want you to take us through that, particularly the age, verifying the age and the categories of the schedules. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks very much, Chair. For his reference, that is Honorable Mtuli. So that we're able to respond, Honorable Mtuli. Honorable van der Merwe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in prevention is better than cure. When I was a councillor, I had this problem. There was a certain house, we call it a song, where they all bring all the street kids together. We can have the best laws in the world. We can have a police system that can work. We must start by the causes that cause this. I have in that house 120 kids, but most of them, 90% of them, have no parents. They're stealing to live on the street. And their ages were between 6 months and 18 years. They send them out after they get the age of 18 years. We have the laws, and we can arrest these people. But those poor kids, I was there helping them off the rooms of the library, where they sleep at night, and some of them died. And it's not such a good feeling, get a person on a roof, I saw dead already, and it could have been prevented. And these laws are good, but I think we must go further, and it's nothing to do maybe with this laws we have, but we must start at the bottom line and see what we can do to prevent these people getting on the streets where they got no place to stay, no food, and they have to break. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
That was the Honorable Van der Meer, eh? Mamianda.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question goes back to the fact. They are saying that the prison commissioner are keeping register. Not all of them, I want to say that. Last year we went to Mbizana police station. The very same station commissioner couldn't read his own report. His own report, he couldn't read it. And we chased him there and there, that day when we were there, out of the police station. Because he was just telling the report like this. Then we end up saying, no, you can't read your report. What do we do with such station commissioner? And my second question, it goes back to Honorable Dudu's question, I'm supporting it. My son went to bank 3 months back to go and catch up his money. To our surprise, he was told, you can't get your money because you are certified dead, heart failure. We've got the death certificate with us. He's busy even now finding out what went wrong. Because he's alive, but he's got a death certificate. Are you people working with Home Affairs finding such things? If I can get that explanation, I'll be happy. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. That was the Honorable Nyanda, NYA. NDA. For easy reference, she's a sister who's two in Yanda. Biological sister for that sense. Yeah, her question is, as you can hear, is when you said the special commissioners are monitoring every day, because some of them are not doing it. When they can't even visit their own cells, they have to see how they those ADCs are doing as those holding cells. Yeah. You are asking this first question, Mamianda, about you and Umpemba, the linkage between Home Affairs and SAP. If Home Affairs can't even know how many people are there in the country with ID, I don't know. Honorable Mamianda.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question will actually relate on part two, sentencing options. I'm looking at Section 73, the restorative justice sentence. I think it comes back to that conglomeration of now family court, where everybody comes together. And among other things, at sub 4 with a small a, it actually gives that kind of a monitoring system to the probation officer. And it goes further, I go with it, but it goes further, where the justice court can then request the probation officer to give a report to see the compliance. Now, here it monitors the child. And among other things, indeed, says the child, if the child expires, then the court, that has sentenced him or her, will call back the child to the inquiry in terms of Section 79. Now, I try to now look at 79, what it speaks of, which it says the fail to comply with a certain sentence. Now, my problem emanates from this one. The other one is the restorative justice. Invariably, if we go on practice, the court, if a child is probably 10 or 11, commit an offense, that is not in the schedule 1 and 2. The court is likely to say, postpone the sentence, say, you will be called after so many, for a year, so and so. You will be called to appear before this court, then the sentence will be passed on that day. That's what you tell the child. Now, the child is not actually aware whether am I convicted or is this a postponement sentence? And if it's postponed, what will happen if anything happens in between? Now, who monitors that? How do a probation officer can monitor that? Because it invariably that has happened, that the child has been told that you will come back in such and such a day and you'll be sentenced. It might be probably a couple of homicides because one of them was saying to a child it's a man. They were playing and the other one died. But that happened now. I would like to know how to synergize the two. Further than that, because also 78, it actually deals with the postponement and suspension of passing of a sentence. That's exactly where it should be. Now, how to synergize the three? That we know what actually will happen. And 179, it says, if the child has failed, in fact it says that it's sort of double sentence imposed in terms of Section 79, or has failed to pay a fine, then the court, in terms of Section 74, will call the child back. Now, does it imply that it will rescind the sentence that it has imposed on the day one when the child has failed and give another sentence? Is that the implication that I get here? Because if you are sentenced to me, you are sentenced. If you have failed to comply with the sentence, you will come back and carry out the practice of that sentence. How is this going to apply if now they would receive the sentence and give a new sentence? I tend to understand. And the last one is on 74, fine and an alternative to fine. 74 says that it speaks of an offense which is a fine appropriate must be before passing a fine. The inquiry into ability of the child or his or her parents or the appropriate adult to pay the fine, whether in full or by the deferred fine, whichever way. Now, here it speaks of a fine. Now, there are two people here, the child and those guardians. Now, if the payment, for instance, the child is not working for start off with,
And the parent, guardian, whoever appropriate other says, I'm not prepared to pay for the fine. What is the court going to do? Because on B, it says to consider whether the failure to pay the fine may cause the child to be in prison. How do we also synergize that? Because if immediately, whether the certified fine, the child is not working, says, I'm not working, I cannot pay. And the other says, I'm not prepared to pay. Is the court going to still postpone it, or is going to impose the sentence immediately? And what would be perfectly? The problem I have is because, including the probation officer, there would be a form that would be a prescribed form that the probation officer should follow. Now, I'm not quite sure what is going to be nice, because the monitoring of the officer is the child. I don't want to be silly. It may be a man, maybe a female. We live in certain circumstances. If it's a man who will be monitoring this child every now and again, I'll find this man at my house at any given time. What's going on here? Or if it's a female, my wife finds this woman now and again, yes, monitoring this child. Yes, do you take that? I mean, we cannot ignore it. These are some of the things that would, if one could see that kind of a form, the prescribed form, which probably might put some of us at ease. Those are the things that I've said, what is about them? What are we trying to do here? Those are the questions. Thank you.
That's a serious one. That was the Honorable Mzizi, M-Z-I-Z-I, Mzizi. Now, I think you know him by now. You know him. The last two members are going to ask questions here. It's Honorable Mac and Honorable West, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. I always struggle to define whether the Honorable is asking a question or telling a big story. He stretches it long and he gives you all the info. But yeah, I'm quite concerned. First, I must say that yesterday we asked a question around probation officers. And I was quite satisfied with the answer. They are capable, they are experienced people. You have two probation officers working with one manager, and that satisfied me a lot. And satisfaction in the way that I'm sure they will do a good job and will prepare good reports. That I'm clear about. But now I'm concerned if I look at 71 with pre-sentence reports. And a pre-sentence report is very, very important. This will determine what sentence is issued or laid upon anyone, any child. And the concern now is at subsection 4, where this pre-sentence report that is being compiled by a probation officer can now be disposed of by a court, and other the recommendations to that can be imposed of, and other sentence can be issued. My question is then, this person, this probation officer, has been working with this child for how long, and has done all this work, and has been in the community, and we are giving powers now to a court which has decided what the reason for the imposition of a different sentence, that this authority lies now with this court. What informs that reason? Why is this probation officer's pre-sentence report now disposed of? Is there no other mechanism where he can where it can be looked at again or be referred back to. Because that's not totally said, it can be discarded. And that, I'm not happy with that. Because this means we are giving away sole power to a court decision. And what then informs that court? What other reports inform that court to then impose a sentence? If it doesn't recognize the probation officer's report. And that, I mean, already we are having problems with lot of sentences that are given and we that we are not happy with. And the sole authority, especially in a child, I don't think it can rest with one person. And you are also, what are you doing to the probation officer? Are you saying to him, if you don't do it, you didn't do a good job? And I'm very concerned about it. Thank you.
That was the Honorable Mac. Honorable West.
Okay, I haven't got many questions. My only one is with regard to social workers. I just hope that there are sufficient social workers to help in the rehabilitation of children, that there are enough there. That's the major thing to be able to carry out these new
Oh, they didn't get the question, Honorable Mac. Can you repeat your question and speak to your mic, please? Honorable West, I'm sorry, Honorable West. Darrell, they didn't get your question. They said that you are using a bedroom voice. They said that please speak to your mic and so that they can get the question.
Thanks, Chair. Now, my only question is with regard to the Act so far is the support of social workers, if there are not social workers to help rehabilitate and implement the Act. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. All questions were noted. We'll get responses, but only after lunch. Can we break for lunch? Let's go and enjoy our juicy, delicious, sumptuous meal over there, and let's come back at 2 to continue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.